Usually when we talk about workplace rules and, discipline, there's a pretty strict expectation of cause and effect.
Right. Yeah, it's supposed to be straightforward.
Exactly. It operates a lot like physics. I mean, you
Yeah.
steal money from the register, you get fired, you fall asleep on a patrol shift, you get written up.
Yeah, we like our administrative rules to be visible and strictly categorized based on verifiable actions.
Right, because that gives you a sense of predictability.
Exactly. The system is supposed to be binary and clean. The conduct triggers the consequence.
But imagine being investigated at work, not for something you actually did, but
Well, yeah.
simply because of who you had coffee with.
Or maybe who you refuse to publicly condemn.
Yeah, suddenly that clean cause and effect rule book just completely breaks down.
It really does.
So today we are doing a deep dive into a really fascinating, highly analytical thought piece by Eric Sanders. This was published on May 3, 2026, and it's titled From Criminal Association to Political Association: NYPD's Expanding Theory of Disloyalty.
And what's so incredible about this piece is that Sanders is really dissecting the raw machinery of how this works.
Right. And just to set the stage here, we aren't here to take political sides, left, right, whatever. We aren't endorsing any underlying civil rights debates or anything like that.
No, definitely not. We're just here to look under the hood of the bureaucracy. We're impartially reporting on the structural mechanics.
Exactly. Our mission for you, the listener, is to break down exactly how modern police departments, and honestly, large bureaucracies by extension, how they weaponize this concept of political association to punish employees.
Because it happens a lot more than you'd think.
Oh, absolutely. So we want to equip you with the exact blueprint to identify these retaliatory investigations, audit your own disciplinary files, and understand the constitutional fault lines that actually protect your rights.
It's basically a survival guide for the modern workplace.
Yeah. So, okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand how a workplace can punish you for your relationships, we first have to look at how police departments historically treat civilians out on the street.
Right, so the author traces this institutional habit back to what we call the criminal association model.
Which is what exactly?
Well, in traditional street policing, a civilian's physical proximity to a known suspect is frequently treated as like an evidentiary substitute for criminal conduct.
Oh, okay. So, like, if they are riding in the passenger seat of the same car.
Exactly. Or even if they just happen to live in the same apartment building as a gang member, the government effectively turns proximity into suspicion.
Wow. Okay. So it's basically a contagion model.
That is a perfect way to describe the underlying mechanism, yeah.
Because the department knows they can't catch or punish an outside critic, right? That outside person doesn't work for them.
Right, they have no jurisdiction over a journalist or a civil rights attorney.
So they just quarantine anyone inside the department who stands next to them.
Exactly. They make the suspicion portable. And the source argues that the department has taken this exact street-level criminal association model and just pointed it inward at their own employees.
But now it's not criminal association, it's political association.
Right, but we need to define political association very carefully here because the term is actually pretty misleading.
How so?
Well, in an institutional setting, political association has almost nothing to do with, registering for a political party or handing out campaign
Oh,
flyers.
really? It's not about Republicans and Democrats.
Not at all. It means proximity to anyone management considers an institutional threat.
Okay. So we are talking about reform advocates, civil rights lawyers, internal whistleblowers, or media figures.
Exactly. The association might be as simple as appearing on a podcast or consulting an attorney about workplace safety.
Or maybe just refusing to disavow a colleague who filed a discrimination lawsuit.
Yes, exactly that. The institution punishes what the employees' relationships are made to mean rather than any actual misconduct.
Because the ultimate goal is to control the external narrative, right?
Oh, yeah.
They suppress the reachable targets inside the building.
You got it. But there's a catch.
What's that?
If management is punishing people for who they talk to, they can't legally write, "You are too close to a critic" on a formal disciplinary form.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
That would trigger a massive First Amendment lawsuit before the ink even dried.
Exactly. They have to hide the motive.
So, how do they formally charge someone without exposing themselves to immediate litigation?
They rely on administrative cover. They use this five-step structural process the author calls the laundering process.
Laundry, like money laundering.
Kind of, yeah, but for administrative charges. So step one is identification. Someone inside the institution simply notices the proximity.
Okay, let's use a hypothetical officer. Let's call him Officer Smith.
Sure, Officer Smith. So management notices Smith having lunch with a known police reform advocate.
And the lunch is completely lawful.
Totally lawful. But the institution secretly labels Smith as a risk.
Okay, so once Smith is marked as a risk, the machinery kicks into step two, which I'm guessing is escalation.
Right, escalation. The internal review starts moving, but it operates under heavily neutralized labels.
Meaning they don't investigate Smith for his political viewpoints.
Exactly. They style the inquiry as a routine check into his quote-unquote professionalism or his compliance with department protocols.
Ah, clever. And that smoothly transitions into step three, construction.
Right. The investigator builds the disciplinary file backward. They gather disparate, often totally unrelated facts to support a predetermined conclusion.
The conclusion being that Smith is just a problematic employee.
Exactly. And then step four is omission.
Which honestly seems like the most insidious part of this whole thing.
Oh, it is the linchpin of the whole process. Management actively ignores any context that would show Smith's lawful purpose.
Or any context that would reveal management's retaliatory motive, right?
Exactly. Like, if Smith had a perfect record for 10 years before that lunch, that context is completely omitted.
Wow. And finally, step five is discipline. The political association is now fully buried under a formal, unrelated charge.
Yeah, the laundering process is complete.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me, though. Management uses intentionally vague disciplinary terms to mask these retaliatory motives.
Oh, heavily. They rely on the vaguest terms possible.
Right. They hit you with phrases like poor judgment or conduct unbecoming or integrity concerns.
Or failure to maintain confidentiality. That's a classic.
It's like a game of administrative Mad Libs where the words protected speech are crossed out and poor judgment is just scribbled in.
That's a great way to put it. Poor judgment is the ultimate catch-all because it's just inherently subjective.
I mean, it can absorb almost any behavior management happens to dislike on any given Tuesday.
Exactly. In a legitimate, functional disciplinary system, broad standards are narrowed down by actual concrete evidence.
And consistent application across the board.
Right. But in an associational discipline system, those broad standards are expanded by motive.
Which means the vague label just invites extreme deference from outside reviewers.
Right, exactly. It frames the targeted employee as reckless and management as simply being responsible stewards of the agency.
So you end up with this massive asymmetry. The targeted employee's words, timing, minor daily actions, all of that is parsed aggressively under a microscope.
Yes.
But management's hostility, their selective enforcement of the rules, the highly coincidental timing of the investigation.
All of that is generously ignored by the system.
Right. The employee's conduct is treated with extreme suspicion, while management's conduct is just given extreme generosity.
It's incredibly frustrating for the people going through it.
I bet. But let me push back on this a bit, though. Let's say I'm an outside arbitrator looking at Officer Smith's file.
Okay.
If the file is stuffed full of memos, official timelines, investigator findings, interview transcripts, I mean, it looks real.
It definitely looks real on paper.
So how does the department actually build a file that looks that legitimate if the whole thing is based on a vague, hidden motive?
Well, they rely on the operational engine of the whole system, which the author calls evidentiary inversion.
Evidentiary inversion. Okay, break that down for us.
Sure. In a normal fact-first investigation, an investigator starts with an open question. What happened here?
Right. You gather facts, you test competing theories, and you eventually arrive at a conclusion based on where the evidence leads.
Exactly. But evidentiary inversion completely flips that timeline. The investigation begins with the conclusion firmly established.
Officer Smith is a problem.
Yes. The investigator then works backward to construct a documentary record that protects that conclusion.
So facts aren't gathered to test the theory. They are gathered to insulate it.
Precisely.
But wait, if I think someone stole a pen from my desk, I'm going to look for video evidence of them taking the pen. Isn't every investigation just looking for proof of guilt?
Looking for proof of a specific ad is normal. The danger arises when you manipulate the parameters of the search to ensure you never accidentally find proof of innocence.
Wow. Okay, that makes sense. So how do you spot this? The author lists some specific warning signs, right?
Yeah, very specific warning signs. The most prominent is witness avoidance.
Witness avoidance. So deliberately not interviewing someone.
Exactly. Say the central witness, maybe the reporter who actually spoke to the officer, might collapse the department's theory by testifying that the officer never leaked anything confidential.
So the investigator just deliberately avoids interviewing them.
Yes. And they will justify it by claiming investigative discretion or saying they already had enough documentation.
When in reality, they are terrified of what the witness will actually put on the official record.
Exactly. It would ruin the narrative.
Another massive warning sign the author points out is context stripping.
Oh, this one is brutal.
Yeah, you take a protected act and surgically sever it from its purpose. The example from the text is just wild.
Right, where an employee reports a severe workplace safety issue to an outside agency.
Yes, and then the department strips away the entire safety reporting context.
They just punish the employee for an unauthorized disclosure of internal floor plans.
Unbelievable. Just totally removing the why.
And we also see what's called disciplinary elasticity. The target constantly moves.
What does that mean in practice?
Well, if internal affairs tries to prove you made an unauthorized disclosure, but the evidence weakens, maybe someone points out the info is already public.
Okay, so they drop the case then, right?
No, they never drop the case. They just shift the charge to creating an appearance of impropriety.
Man. So the investigation survives by constantly changing its shape to fit whatever meager facts are available.
Exactly.
So if an employee wants to prove the file is inverted, they shouldn't just look at what the investigator put in the file.
Right. That's exactly the point.
They have to look at the negative space. They have to point out the glaring holes where evidence should be.
Completeness of paperwork does not equal reliability. A file can be 3 inches thick and still be evidentially hollow.
Right. Inverted investigations contract rather than expand when contrary facts appear.
That's a perfect summary.
But if management is this skilled at hiding their motives behind vague terms and thick stacks of manicured paperwork, how on earth does a judge look at that and see a First Amendment violation?
That is the big question. And this is where the constitutional fault lines really get tested in the courtroom.
Because it's not just an HR issue, it's a constitutional issue.
Exactly. Courts differentiate between valid disciplinary actions and protected First Amendment activity using a framework built on a few foundational Supreme Court cases.
Okay, let's walk through those. What's the first hurdle?
The first hurdle is the Pickering test. The Supreme Court established decades ago that public employees do not surrender their constitutional rights at the workplace door.
Right, but there's a balancing act, isn't there?
Yes. Pickering requires a judge to balance a public employee's interest in commenting on matters of public concern against the government's interest in providing efficient public service.
But the word efficiency does a lot of heavy lifting there. I mean, management will always argue that an employee talking to a critic disrupts the efficiency of the department because it creates drama.
Right. They always argue that. But the courts have been clear that efficiency must mean actual demonstrable operational harm.
Okay, so it cannot just mean that management felt embarrassed.
Or that the police chief was annoyed by a news article.
Exactly.
Then there's the Garcetti decision.
Garcetti, what does that one do?
It draws a strict line between speaking pursuant to your official duties and speaking as a private citizen.
Okay, so if you are writing a memo as part of your daily job requirements,
that speech generally isn't protected by the First Amendment. But if you are speaking as a private citizen on a matter of public concern, it is protected.
But I'm guessing the department's countermove is usually to claim that because you wear a badge, everything you do 24 hours a day is an official duty.
Oh, absolutely. They try to swallow your entire life into your job description.
Right. But the author argues that is a massive overreach.
It is. But honestly, the absolute most crucial ruling for associational discipline is a Supreme Court case called Heffernan.
Heffernan. I want to spend some time on this one because the mechanics of it are so powerful.
You really are. So in Heffernan, a police officer picked up a political campaign yard sign for his bedridden mother.
Okay.
Other officers saw him holding the sign, and they assumed he supported the candidate who happened to be running against the incumbent police chief.
And let me guess, the officer was demoted.
Exactly. He was demoted.
But the craziest part is the officer didn't even support the candidate. He was literally just running an errand for his mom.
And that is the brilliant core of the Heffernan ruling. The Supreme Court held that the constitutional injury is based entirely on the employer's motive.
Wow. So it doesn't matter that the department was totally mistaken about the officer's political beliefs.
It doesn't matter at all. If they punish the officer based on their perceived alignment with a political figure or a critic, it is a First Amendment violation.
Because the injury lies in the government's retaliatory use of power to suppress what they believe is political association.
Exactly. It's about their intent to suppress.
So the department really doesn't own your civic identity just because they sign your paycheck.
Employment gives the department authority over work-related conduct, not ownership over your lawful associations.
And for you listeners in New York, the author points out New York Labor Law Section 201-10.
Yes, that is a huge piece of the puzzle for New Yorkers.
It provides immense statutory protection for lawful, off-duty political activities and legal recreational activities.
It gives officers a simple way to protect their speech rights off-duty without having to navigate the massive burden of a full federal constitutional claim.
Which is great, but here's the thing. When an individual officer's off-duty rights are violated and they get hit with a bogus poor judgment charge, it's a tragedy for that one officer's career.
Definitely.
But if a department runs this exact playbook 100 times, they aren't just creating individual tragedies, they're creating a culture.
Yes. The individual retaliation elevates into a massive institutional liability.
And the author refers to this systemic impact as institutional silence by design.
Right, because the real goal of punishing Officer Smith isn't just to discipline Officer Smith.
No, the goal is to make a highly visible example out of him.
Exactly. To induce a chilling effect across the entire agency. They want the other 2,000 officers to watch Smith get transferred to the night shift, look at his ruined career, and decide to just self-censor.
It is managing behavior through predictable, visible risk.
And legally, this systemic chilling effect triggers what lawyers call Monell liability.
Okay, Monell liability.
Yeah.
I want to dig into this because suing a city isn't like suing a regular company, is it?
No, it's much harder. You can't just say the supervisor did something bad, so the city has to pay.
Right. Under the Monell doctrine, a municipality only becomes financially liable when the constitutional violations are the result of an institutional policy, practice, or custom.
And it is incredibly difficult to prove. You have to show that the unconstitutional retaliation wasn't just, you know, a rogue supervisor acting out on a bad day.
You have to prove it's a deeply ingrained custom of the department itself.
Exactly.
But here's my favorite analogy from the piece. You don't need a written gag order taped to the precinct wall if the walls themselves are made of glass.
The custom is written in the sequence of enforcement.
Right. So to prove that an unwritten custom exists, the author relies heavily on a recent Second Circuit case, Chislett.
Yes, Chislett. It establishes how a custom forms without a written rule.
And how does it form?
It happens through supervisory acquiescence. It happens through inaction in the face of known misconduct.
So if senior officials consistently review disciplinary files that have glaring, obvious investigative defects like missing key witnesses,
and they relay those approvals up the chain of command anyway,
then that relay of approvals creates a legally actionable hostile custom.
Precisely. If the department knows a retaliatory environment exists and actively chooses to do nothing to correct it, their inaction effectively becomes the official policy.
Okay, so let's get really practical here. If you are a listener caught in the gears of this machinery, or you feel you're being targeted with administrative scrutiny just because of who you associate with, What are the exact actionable steps you can take to fight back?
Right. How do you defend yourself?
Yeah. If I'm sitting at my desk staring at a write-up for conduct unbecoming, what is the literal first thing I should write down on my legal pad to start building my defense?
You have to audit the disciplinary file backward to expose the evidentiary inversion. The author provides a specific blueprint with four types of proof you need to document.
Okay, let's list those out. The very first thing you write down is trigger proof.
Yes. Trigger proof, you must document the sequence of events.
Like what happened right before the scrutiny began.
Exactly. Write down the exact date management became aware of your political association or your protected off-duty activity, and the date the seemingly random disciplinary scrutiny began.
So if the association came first, and the vague charge materialized immediately after, that sequence identifies the hidden motive.
You are looking for the catalyst. Once you have trigger proof, you move to process proof.
Process proof. This is where you map out the negative space we discussed earlier, right?
Yes. You list every witness the investigator deliberately failed to interview. You catalog the exculpatory evidence they omitted from the final report.
And you document every time they refused to test contrary explanations.
Exactly. That's your process proof. Third is comparator proof.
Comparator proof. So how they treat you compared to someone else.
Exactly. You have to document how the department treats other employees who engage in the exact same conduct but don't associate with critics.
Okay, so if five other officers routinely speak to external vendors without getting disciplined, but you get hit with a poor judgment charge only after speaking to a reform advocate,
you have just proven selective enforcement.
Wow. Okay. And finally, you need supervisory proof.
Right. Note exactly who approved these flawed charges up the chain.
Because this is how you build the institutional handoff required for Monell liability.
Yes. Who had the authority to stop the retaliatory investigation, saw the glaring holes in the file, and chose to sign off on it instead?
That is so practical. The golden rule for any targeted employee is to force the department to prove conduct, not just proximity.
Make them state the exact rule violated, the specific physical act you committed, and the concrete operational harm it caused.
Never let them litigate your career through vague, subjective labels.
Absolutely.
Because whether you are in law enforcement, working in a corporate bureaucracy, or simply an engaged citizen trying to understand the news, recognizing how administrative language is used as a weapon to suppress dissent is a vital tool for navigating the modern workplace.
It really is. Protecting your rights starts with understanding when the rules are being used as cover for retaliation. When vague administrative language goes entirely unchallenged, it allows large institutions to enforce strict ideological conformity under the protective guise of professionalism.
Right. It suppresses the very people who are most equipped to expose actual misconduct and keep the public safe.
Exactly.
Now, the department's ultimate excuse for associational discipline, the reason they claim they absolutely have to punish people who associate with critics, is that they must protect public confidence.
Right. That's always the defense.
But consider this. You can't fix a broken x-ray machine by firing the guy who happened to eat lunch with the technician who reported the machine was broken.
Exactly.
If a government agency successfully builds an architecture of fear that permanently silences internal whistleblowers and their associates, they are mathematically guaranteeing an eventual catastrophic scandal.
By silencing the warning bells, they guarantee the crash.
Right. By punishing proximity to the truth today, aren't they ensuring the destruction of the very public confidence they claim to be protecting tomorrow?
That is the tragic irony of the whole system.
Something for all of you to think about as you navigate your own workplaces. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.